Dan Clough is one of New England's leading appellate and First Amendment attorneys, also president of the Connecticut Council on Freedom of Information. He's got a couple of websites, ctgoodgov.com, about good governance in the state of Connecticut, and also appealingbrief.com. Dan, welcome to CT on the Hill.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Now, you wrote a piece, one of your latest pieces, about why the Connecticut General Assembly could be in violation of the Constitution by not voting on these contracts negotiated between the, in this case, Malloy administration and state public employee unions. Let's start there. How come they might be in violation of the Constitution?
Well, the simplest way to put it is that the legislature, which is the House and the Senate in Connecticut, is charged by the Constitution with the responsibility to make the laws in Connecticut. The governor executes the laws, and the judicial branch decides if particular cases have, involve a violation of the law. What happens with collective bargaining contracts in Connecticut, however, is that state law tells the governor to go and negotiate them with the state employee unions, and that's perfectly fine. But then the collective bargaining agreements are submitted to the legislature, and if the legislature doesn't take any action at all, they become law. They have the force of law. And what I've been writing about is explaining how the legislature has essentially given away its constitutional prerogative, its authority to make the law, to a different branch of government. And there are serious questions as to whether or not the legislature can give away its lawmaking power to another branch of government.
So let's examine it from the definition of law. In other words, is this contract, this pact between the governor and the unions, is that considered law?
Well, if you're referring to the recent deal on pension reform, or are you referring to
whether it's the recent deal on pension reform, or whether it's just over collective bargaining as they negotiate a new contract, is that contract essentially considered a law which must be put before the legislature for a vote?
Well, that's the problem. It is put before the legislature. It's submitted. That is, the governor submits the deal that he struck with the unions. The problem is that the law right now says that if the legislature doesn't vote within 30 days, the agreement becomes law. That's the strange part about this. So instead of, if you go back to, ninth grade civics class, everybody learns in high school that the legislature, somebody proposes a bill, and then it has a vote, and people go on the record and they say yay or nay, and if a majority of the elected representatives vote in favor of the bill, it becomes a law. That's not the case with collective bargaining agreements. No legislature has to cast a vote at all, and the failure to vote within 30 days means that the bill becomes a law. And that's the problem that I'm describing in the pieces that I've been writing.
Well, I guess, that sort of clarifies it. In other words, this is no different than, let's say, the legislature debating cell phone bans. If, in fact, they vote on it and then it's signed by the governor, it becomes law. This is essentially the same thing, right?
Well, it should be the same thing. In other words, what we would like to see is the collective bargaining agreement submitted to the legislature, a debate on whether it's a good deal, a bad deal, can the state afford it, so on and so forth. And then at the end of the debate, the legislators vote. And if there's a majority in favor, the collective bargaining agreement becomes law. That's not what happens in Connecticut. And that's the problem. What happens in Connecticut is that under the 1977 statute that created or authorized collective bargaining in Connecticut, there's something called a deemed approved provision. And that's what I'm talking about. It says that when the governor completes his negotiations with the unions and they reach a deal, he submits the deal to the legislature. And if the legislature doesn't vote within 30 days, the deal is deemed approved. That's the problem that I'm focusing on, and that a lot of legislators are concerned about. And in fact, we saw at the very beginning of this session that the leaders, Republican leaders in the House and the Senate, Themis Claridis and Len Fasano, brought up a bill that would require all collective bargaining agreements to be voted on. And that bill failed on a party line vote.
Well, and we all know the politics of this. The Republicans for years have stated that they've wanted a vote, that they'll go on the record and vote for these contracts. They allege that the Democrats either don't want to be on the record as voting for or against these contracts for political reasons. So there's the politics involved in this as well, Dan.
Absolutely. No question about it. And I can easily understand why folks don't want to have to cast a vote on these bills. But the fact is that in a democracy, legislators are supposed to go on the record, yay or nay, so that their constituents know what their position is on a bill. And then they can decide the next time that that official runs for office, do I want to vote for this person or do I not want to vote for them because of their record? The problem with the way collective bargaining agreements are implemented in Connecticut now is that you don't have to have a vote. And again, what I'm trying to discuss in these pieces that I've been writing on my blog is that there may be a serious constitutional problem with the lack of a vote, because in essence, that means that the executive branch, that's the governor, is now making law without any input from the legislative branch.
Is there enough there, so to speak, to have a legal challenge to the fact the legislature seems to be abdicating its responsibility?
Well, that is the $65,000 question. I can say this. I would not have raised the issue of the possible constitutional defect unless I thought it was a serious question, you know, something that lawyers, regardless of their ideological perspective, left, right, conservative, whatever, unless they thought it was a serious issue. But I would not want to mislead your listeners into believing that there is that I think the answer is crystal clear. The truth is, I don't know how the Connecticut Supreme Court would ultimately resolve this issue. But I do think it's a serious one that should be considered if the legislature doesn't change the law to require votes on collective bargaining agreements.
Now, you know, you've been before many courts. Could it be that that 1977 deal between the, at the time, the 1977 deal, which includes that area where they essentially could perform a pocket veto, just don't take any action for 30 days, could the court cite that as stating, well, that was the intention of the legislature, and so we'll live with the intention of the legislature?
That is possible, no question, that is possible, but let me tell you what the problem with that is. Again, so the state constitution says that the way a bill, a legislative proposal becomes a law is by submitting it to both houses, the Senate and the House, and a majority of both houses vote in favor of it. That's what the constitution requires. So the question is, could the legislature pass a law that says, in the future, we are going to require something less than what the Constitution requires for something to become law? And that is in essence what the 1977 Act does. It says, hey, you future legislators, when you're confronted with a collective bargaining agreement that the governor's negotiated and it's submitted to you, you don't have to vote. And if you don't vote, it's going to become law. Well, that's a subversion of what the state constitution requires. So to go back to your question about the 1977 Act, a question that a court would have to answer is, can one legislature make it easier for a future legislature allow something to become law? Can it become easier than what the Constitution requires? And generally speaking, legislators cannot amend the Constitution by passing a statute. That amendments to the Constitution have to go for to the ballot for a full vote by the citizens of Connecticut.
Do you see any group on the horizon that might actually take that step and challenge it in court if, in fact, the legislature doesn't address this issue in this session?
I don't know. I suppose I haven't had any conversations with any groups. Nobody's raised the issue with me, so I'd only be speculating. But at the end of the day, you know, it's really going to be up to the Republicans in the House and the Senate to decide how far they want to push this issue, how important it is. I should say that recent reports in the newspapers indicate that the Democrats are willing to reconsider the bill that was proposed very early, you know, just last week, that would require a vote. I think that's a very promising sign, and I hope that they do reconsider that bill later in this session, because having the legislature decide to vote on collective bargaining and contracts is a much better outcome than filing a lawsuit and getting the courts to decide.
No question about it. I must tell you that when we had Themis Claridis on the program last week and I brought this up, she wasn't as optimistic. She said the Democrats have known for years what our position is on this issue, and we haven't changed it when we introduced that amendment. So she didn't buy into the explanation that it was thrust on them in the first day of the session, but, you know, we'll see what happens. Meanwhile, on the Senate side, now that it's tied, can we expect a battle on this in the Senate?
Well, so that's a fascinating issue. As I'm sure your readers know, the Senate in Connecticut is tied. I think it at the moment is 17-17.
Right.
And there's a power-sharing agreement. So, Senator Fasano, who now has the ability, even though he has the ability to raise issues in the Senate. And again, I haven't spoken to him about this. I do not have any inside track on this, but I wouldn't be surprised if he were to force a vote on collective bargaining agreements in the Senate, at least require all senators to go on the record. And we'll just have to wait and see that if that happens, but I wouldn't be surprised if it does. And then the interesting question would be, okay, what does the House do if the Senate actually votes? Does it follow suit? Yeah. I hope it does, but we'll have to wait and see.
Well, what would be especially would be interesting is if it comes down to a 17-17 tie in the Senate, how would the lieutenant governor vote? Because she would be the tiebreaker, right?
Well, that's true, and I don't think there'd be a huge surprise how she would vote. But there are several Democrats who are not... You know, they're willing to buck the party line,
right?
This may be a situation where the Democrats aren't able to get all of their folks in the Senate to continually vote against something that really is just a sensible Democratic good governance bill.
We will see. Talking with Attorney Dan Clough, one of New England's leading appellate and First Amendment attorneys. Dan, talk a bit about what is a great website, your website, CT Good Governance.
Oh, well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to chat about it. So I created the website last year. I've been blogging for a long time on purely legal issues, but I really wanted to talk about ways to improve the democratic system, the way our government operates. Generally speaking, people are focused on the personalities of individuals who run for office and the specific policies that they're espousing. That's generally where our focus is as citizens. The point of my website, the CT Good Gov website, is to talk about what I see as defects in the way the system operates, in the design of the system. So let me give you a very simple example that some folks have talked about, that Senator Kennedy talked about it recently. It's something called e-certification or emergency certification. And it's a process that allows a bill to bypass the normal requirements of public hearings and debates and just go straight to a vote. The classic example where we've seen that e-certification used recently is on the budget.
Right.
So the leadership negotiates the budget largely behind closed doors, and then at the very end of the session, it dumps a several hundred page, densely worded budget bill on the desks of rank and file legislators who have no meaningful opportunity to review it and talk to their constituents about it and debate it. That is, that process, e-certification, is abused time and time again. So I talk at points in my blog about how we should change the rules governing e-certification, so that bills are debated and there's an opportunity for them, to be considered and the public to consider them before votes. So it's really about going back to first principles and looking at the design of our state government, the rules and procedures by which it operates, and finding ways to amend or change those rules so that you get better outcomes from our elected representatives.
Well, and you're absolutely right about that. And there they are voting in the on the 11th hour on a state budget, in some cases a two-year state budget plan. And they're doing things. They're scrambling around last minute. I understand you've got the committee process and these supporters and detractors want to go before committees, but the budget should be debated and voted on long before the legislature comes to an adjournment, Dan.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is a bipartisan issue. You know, I am a progressive Democrat. I'm not ideological about it, but I have, you know, strong sort of progressive views. But on something like this, what I hear when I talk to folks over at the legislative office building on both sides of the aisle is extreme discontent with how little input rank and file folks have into one of the most important things that the legislature does, passing a budget. So it's not a Democratic issue. It's not a Republican issue. It's a what I call a good government issue. And both parties should be supportive of improving the design of the system and the rules that govern how the legislature operates so that you get better legislation and therefore and better democracy.
Attorney Dan Clough, one of New England's leading appellate and First Amendment attorneys, president of the Connecticut Council on Freedom of Information, has been our guest. Dan, thanks very much for spending some time with us this morning.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Dan.